Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman for our Christmas week episode. Bruce, we have a really special guest. Pleased to have the outgoing Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney on the show here in a little bit. He is down to his last 10 days or so on the job. But first, how was your viewing experience first weekend of bowl games?
It was good. I got to see most of the games. One thing I'll say is there was three NFL games that ran on Saturday, and those games were more competitive than some of the bowl games. I got to admit, hats off to FAU. They had a coaching change, and even without the coaching change, I think a lot of people would have thought, okay, you have a bigger group of five, really good team, SMU, against a smaller group of five, and it turned out to be a blowout, but not the way probably a lot of us would have expected. So hats off to the Owls. I thought that was a real head-turner. The other one that jumped out at me, I think, is Kent State, considering how bad that program was not long ago. I mean, Sean Lewis has stepped up there and really made a huge impact. They are a fun team to watch. They got their first bowl win in school history on the first day of the bowl games, and it was one of those reminders of what I think, because they had to really scrap just to get to be bowl eligible. I think that they are a great example of why, no, there aren't too many bowls. This was a 500 team that got into a bowl game. They were impressive in how they handled it, and it means a ton to that program, and I think those players deserve the spotlight.
Yeah, I got that one wrong. I think I picked Utah State to win by like 30. Whoops. That's bowl season for you. The SMU one, SMU-FAU, definitely surprised me as well. I think that SMU is one of those teams that got a lot of hype because they were doing things they hadn't done in a long time, and then it just kind of unraveled. Their signature win was TCU, and then TCU doesn't end up making a bowl game. So they had that crazy shootout with Memphis, though. What's interesting is there was a time when everybody was lobbying for their respective team or conference for the Group of Five New Year's Six Bowl. And Mike Oresko was furious that at one point SMU was ranked behind Appalachian State. Obviously, Mountain West people were furious that Boise State didn't get more credit compared to the AAC. And then SMU gets blown out, and Boise State, Mountain West champ, gets blown out by Washington. Honestly, a Washington team that wasn't all that great this year, but I felt like, and kind of, I think you had the same hunch as well in Chris Peterson's last game, that they would come to play, and they did. That was a thorough domination, and now we all wait to see what Jacob Eason will do.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is now Jimmy Lake's program. There's already been a little staff shakeup. Bush Hamden, the offensive coordinator who was there for two seasons, he is already out, as well as one other offensive assistant. So one thing to keep an eye on, I'm going to have a story on this on The Athletic later this week, is there's a lot of sizable offensive coordinator vacancies out there. There's a bunch in the Pac-12. Oregon is looking for an offensive coordinator, as is Washington, as is Cal. I think there's going to be quite a few more coming. There could be a few big ones in the South, as well as the ones that already have had coaching changes where they're looking for guys. So that's an interesting subplot to keep an eye on over the next couple of weeks. Again, as we mentioned a few weeks back, we both have a lot of respect for Chris Peterson. I thought it was cool to see the way he went out. We'll see if he ever comes back to coaching or what he does next. He's somebody I would love to have on the podcast at some point down the road, just because I always thought he was one of the more interesting people in coaching, even though sometimes he didn't always want to show you his hand publicly. So hats off to him. Stu, before we get to Jim Delaney, though, this is probably our only chance to, at least on the Audible, to talk about the semifinal games. And you'd think it feels like they're way off in the distance, but as we're taping this, They're less than a week away. Feels like they're right up on us. Does it, I mean, to me,
the teams arrived, and we're recording this on this part on Sunday night, and the teams arrived. I think a couple of them at least. Ohio State, I know, arrived in Phoenix already. It's nuts. It's playoff semifinal week already.
So how do you break this down? I know you didn't want to tip your hand on what was going on, and especially in your bowl game. You're going to be covering the one in Phoenix. I'm going to be covering the one in Atlanta for The Athletic. So it's time for you to reveal what you think is going to happen between Clemson and Ohio State.
Well, we both made our picks, right? So they're out there on The Athletic for the world to see. Let me ask you, do you feel that either Clemson or Ohio State has an evident weakness?
I would say the thing that I would be most concerned with when it comes to Ohio State is it's been a little while since they played on this big of a stage, and it's new. It's going to be new for Justin Fields. I think he's super talented. But the other guy, who he knows well because they're both Georgia kids, Trevor Lawrence has shined on the biggest stage, and that's the part where if there's an advantage to Clemson, that's where I think it is. And I think that big game experience is, especially in the semifinal, I think it really can make a difference. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think that could be a possible factor. If you want to go flip side, you could say that Clemson hasn't played any big games all season, right? The Ohio State has at least been battle-tested in games like going on the road and playing Michigan and playing Wisconsin for the Big Ten Championship. Penn State, was, I think, the second to last week of the regular season. Clemson's just been kind of going through the motions for a few months now. But like you said, it's not like this is an inexperienced team. Clemson's an extremely experienced team. Most of their key guys, especially in offense, have played in the national championship game. The only thing I don't know about is, for all the talk of how great Clemson's defense has been this year, you just kind of think, like, can that possibly be true? Can it really possibly be true that they lost that entire NFL starting defensive line and aren't going to feel the effect at all? I mean, it may be that they just haven't faced an offense that can exploit it, and certainly Ohio State could, but I ended up picking Clemson close, and I just said, I don't have no idea how the football part of this is going to go, so I'm just going to, if I have to bet money on this, I'm going to bet on Dabo Swinney and Brent Venables and Tony Elliott, who have done this 5 years in a row now, over Ryan Day. Nothing against Ryan Day. He's had a phenomenal year, but obviously this is his first go-around leading a team into the playoff.
So you're picking Clemson in a blowout?
I'm picking Clemson by a field goal.
Okay.
Why would you say blowout?
I'm just trying to stir you up. What's the score you picked?
I picked 34-31.
Okay. I was afraid you were going to say I picked Clemson 27-24 because that's the score I picked. And as we said on the last episode, we both had the exact same score. I'm trying to remember what game that was. Whatever game that was, I'm guessing
was
we
the,
both got it wrong.
Bahamas Bowl. Buffalo. And I don't think either of us came close.
Buffalo Charlotte. We both got that kind of right. Fair enough. So we're both pretty much in agreement. We like the seasoning over maybe just the newness that, who knows? It would not surprise me if Ohio State, honestly, this is a game where it would not surprise me if either team won by two touchdowns.
I don't think there's any outcome that would surprise me either way, other than just one of the teams completely embarrassing the other, because they've been too good to this point all season. You know, to go 13-0.
Do you think there's less, because this is 2 weeks away? Do you think there's less of a chance for some kind of shocking outcome because there's not much of a lag between the end of their, not regular season, but their conference championship games and the semifinal game?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. It's not that usual long, long layoff where teams can get out of rhythm. Now, you do have the factor of, and certainly with LSU, right, Joe Burrow, like these guys, all of these teams have had guys who were on the banquet circuit for a week. They had finals. Like, there are factors like that. But, man, I always think back to the ultimate, all-time lay an egg on the big stage performance, which was Ohio State against Florida. in 2006. And in that case, they went from that 1-2 Michigan game. It was on like November 18th. And then they didn't play again until January 7th or 8th or something like that. This is a much different deal.
Yeah. Okay. So the other semifinal, big gap in, I believe the spread, at least when we picked it, was 13.5. I don't know if it's moved in the Peach Bowl. Some news, especially out of the Oklahoma side, they are down 3 players from suspension. The key one really being Ronnie Perkins. He's their best edge rusher, really has blossomed this year. And also Delarian Turner Yell, who has been one of their better DBs as a safety, broken collarbone, not expected to play. On the LSU side, there's question about Clyde Edwards-Helaire, who's a really terrific running back, and his hamstring, from what we're hearing. We're not sure the severity of it at this point. So, what do you read into this?
Yeah, Clyde Edwards-Helaire would be a pretty big loss for LSU. I think he's been certainly a crucial part of their run. But then you turn around and you've got these Oklahoma suspensions. I just don't know what the case is for Oklahoma to pull the upset. And it seems strange to say that about this is not a upstart team. This is a brand name program. It's been the playoff the last 2 years. They went 12-1. They had the Heisman runner up at quarterback. They are, by all accounts, a really good team. They just happen to be playing, I think, a great team, an elite team. And I would say that of any of LSU, Ohio State, and Clemson. So I picked LSU 41, Oklahoma 27.
Okay, I picked LSU 49, Oklahoma 28. I would expect the Sooners, who run the ball more than they have in a long time, especially with the quarterback run game and Jalen Hurts. Wouldn't surprise me if Jalen Hurts carried it 25 to 30 times in this game. Part of it, I think, is because they will look and say, okay, well, there's a few teams who've had success running the ball against LSU. Now, this may have been a little bit of a different LSU defense when teams were having that success, but also I think in part because you just want to do whatever you can to keep Joe Burrow off the field. And if that means grinding it out on the run game, and I think Oklahoma's good at that. Now, they do lose Ramondre Stevenson, who was not the starting running back, but he was their more physical running back between he and Kennedy Brooks. So they are a little bit down in the backfield as well. But to me, that's their best hope. And the other thing is, for as much as Alex Grinch has preached about getting turnovers, they haven't had a ton of them. They're going to need to, I think, if they have any hope of winning the game, they're going to have a big night on the plus side on the turnover battle if they want to stay up with this LSU offense.
So now that we both picked LSU to win handily and to score in the 40s, the score will be 24 to 23 or something. I don't know. It's hard to see that, but I do agree with one thing you said, which is if I'm Oklahoma, I'm going to run the ball with Jalen Hurts over and over. I would watch the tape of the Ole Miss game and do what they did. Now, I think LSU will probably be better prepared for this than they were for that game. And wasn't that game the week after they played Alabama?
It was bad timing. So at that point, Grant Delpit was not Grant Delpit. He was playing with a high ankle sprain. I think that's a different team now compared to what they were at that point.
Back to the podcast in a minute, but first a word from our sponsor, DoorDash. Your sweatpants are on for the day, but you're sick of microwave leftovers and frozen pizza. Enter DoorDash, restaurant quality food with a living room dress code. DoorDash connects you with your favorite restaurants in your city. Ordering is easy. You open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you wherever you are. I used it on conference championship Saturday to get my favorite chicken kebab restaurant delivered to my door. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code Audible. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code Audible. Don't forget, that's promo code Audible for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. All right, so for our interview with Jim Delaney, I mean, I just want to say we had a half hour with him, and that's a pretty good amount of time for an interview, but there's just so much more we could have gotten to. I mean, he was the commissioner for 30 years. He was the one who spearheaded Penn State coming into the conference. He created the Big Ten Network. He had that ill-fated legends and leaders decision. Like, there's just so much that we never even got to. I think we ended up focusing more on where he sees college sports going after he leaves. So here we go. Here's the interview. We're very pleased now to be joined by the Big Ten commissioner, at least for the next week and a half or so, Jim Delaney.
Right.
Jim, I assume it's not a coincidence you picked January 1, the Rose Bowl, as your last day.
Well, I sort of backed into that because my contract goes through June of 2020. And, you know, when the president's identified Kevin Warren as my successor, sixth commissioner of the Big Ten, you know, they asked me, you know, what about the transition? I said, well, I'd like to talk to Kevin about his availability, and that'll have an awful lot of sort of meaning to how I can help in the transition. And so Kevin really needed July and August to wrap up his affairs in Minneapolis, and he came to work as a full-time person at the Big Ten on September 16. And I really thought it would be smart to use the fall, at least a couple months in the fall, to familiarize him with all of our partners, from media to lawyers, to commissioners, to NCAA, to bowls. So that's what he's been doing, at the same time getting exposed to conference operations and processes. And that's pretty much completed. And he's actually in my space now. I'm out of the office, but you know, we're talking on a daily basis. We had a nice Christmas party last night. And so it sort of backed into it because I thought, well, you know, I'll be out of there first of January. And then realizing the Rose Bowl was there and we have a semifinal game, I thought it'd be fun to stay through those things. And so, you know, he'll become the commission late on January 1. And we and our families will travel together to Phoenix and then to Pasadena. But really, transition is complete. He's in his role, not officially commish yet, but basically he's ready to step into that arena and think he's exceptionally well prepared for that.
As Stuart was saying, this is the last week and a half. You had mentioned there was a Christmas party. I remember in the conference meetings in Arizona at the Big Ten reception, I think the first night, a bunch of the media partners as well as people within the conference had spoken up and gave some testimonials and some heartfelt words. Yep. So I would think since this has been quite a lengthy transition, I mean, are you typically a sentimental guy? And like, where's your head been as kind of going through this journey of seeing it all?
Well, you know, that happened, I guess that was probably in April or May. And so some of our coaches were there and our partners, I think ESPN and Fox were both there. And so we didn't know who was going to be the successor. And to be honest with you, I mean, I thought there was a possibility I could leave on September 1st, January 1st, or June 30th, depending upon, because the presidents didn't really hire Kev until I think it was early June. And so we sort of needed to know. I mean, I really wasn't sure, you know, whether or not I would be turning it over in the summer or the fall, the winter or the spring. And so while I think, you know, I'm not going back to Phoenix in the role as commissioner anyway, but we were there. So I think Mark and a few other people, you know, just got our coaches together, got our partners together, and did some toasting. I'm really glad we did because, you know, what we've tried to do, and it's been an awful lot of fun, is to have, you know, nothing really public. It's been meetings with former ADs. And we had a toast with our presidents at their final meeting in Indianapolis. I'll do something with Rose Bowl friends at the Rose Bowl. But pretty much no all-comers events, pretty small intimate gatherings of the people that we've worked closely with the last 25, 30 years. And that was the first. And probably the Rose Bowl will be the last. So, yeah, it's been nostalgic. You know, my wife is emotional. I'm really, you know, not that sentimental. I feel great about it because of what all of us have done together. We haven't, you know, hasn't been without, you know, challenges, but basically kind of the culture, the coordination, the collaboration inside the conference over a long period of time, I think, you know, everybody's feeling pretty good, including me.
So there was a time when I used to see you on the sideline before the Rose Bowl almost every year. There was also a time earlier this decade when I feel like I spent a lot of time stalking you at outside meeting rooms and chasing you into elevators as you guys debated, you know, what ended up becoming the college football playoff. I mean, there were many years there where you were having to balance the, you know, what others in the sport may have wanted for the postseason and what was best for the Big Ten, Pac-12, and Rose Bowl. Six years into it, I mean, this way you're ending this is kind of a perfect symmetry to go from this semifinal game in Phoenix to the traditional Big Ten Pac-12 game. But I don't think it's any secret that as this has progressed, the playoff has become a much bigger deal. The Rose Bowl is still obviously a great event. I don't know that it's viewed the way it was 10 years ago, just because of the playoff. I mean, in the end, do you feel like what you ended up coming to, the trade-off there, has worked the way you thought about it, or differently?
I mean, I think in any negotiation, you know, you work with what you have, and really the public desire for more games, a more, you know, enhanced playoff, you know, controlled a lot. So as people changed, as Mike came to the realization that you could have an undefeated team from the SEC not involved, he became a proponent. And then he and John were proponents, but he didn't enjoy support from a lot of us, Pac-12, Big 12. It was a minority of two. But I think that, you know, there was a momentum to it from a public perception. There was a lot of criticism, but it did last a long time. I mean, yeah, I guess it lasted from 1998 to 2014. And the growth of football during that period of time was pretty enormous, and it continues to be enormous. I was just reading this morning how well CBS has done, how well ESPN has done, how well Fox has done, at least on the media side. You know, there's attendance challenges, but I think those are challenges that exist not only in this country but around the world in terms of how people consume content and the time they devote to it. But I would tell you this about the Rose Bowl. I didn't fully comprehend the Rose Bowl, although I watched it as a kid growing up. But I wasn't from the Midwest, and I wasn't from the West Coast. But it was obvious to me very soon in my tenure that it, in fact, was the most important external relationship the Big Ten had, and had to navigate the transition eventually to the BCS, because we had schools that were, you know, ranked two or three and wanted a chance to play for the championship. An undefeated Penn State team in 94 was ranked by the media and others as number two. They're a pretty good team. We shared one in, I think, 97. And so there was an internal interest as well as external pressure. But it took time to do it in a way that accommodated the national scene but also protected the Rose Bowl as much as we could. And as you guys know, there were a couple different iterations of the BCS over that, you know, maybe 16-year period, from single hosting to double hosting. And if you look at the ratings, if you look at attendance, I would tell you that in a lot of cases, the Rose Bowl was right there with the BCS championship game. As you move forward into the next system, more people have a chance to play in the Rose Bowl. It was exclusively us for so many years, and I think they appreciate the venue. I have a feeling, and this is just a personal observation, that the Rose Bowl has retained its brand value, its day, its time, its rating. It doesn't rate like it did in the 70s. It used to do 30s. Now it'll do a 10 or 11 or 12 or 13. but it is among the most highly rated postseason games. It does host a semifinal. And I think because it's been touched by more players and coaches from more conferences, what I hear often from my colleagues is, you know, we should not be moving this around. It, the national championship should be in the Rose Bowl every year. Now, that probably wouldn't happen, but I would just say it's been pretty remarkable that the Rose Bowl has maintained its brand in a unique way. And in my sense, abilities, it's one of the top five sports brands in the world. I think the Rose Bowl is that special today, and I'm glad we're able to maintain it at the level that it's at.
Jimmy, when you talk about the Rose Bowl, especially for me living out here in Southern California, I feel like I can say I get it, and I, you know, you get the uniqueness that is there. And as somebody who I did grow up in, not New Jersey, but near there, and so I kind of didn't grow up in Big Ten or Pac-12 country, but yep, you kind of come to realize what it is. But I think for a lot of people who are not either connected to the Rose Bowl in some way,
yep,
I think to them the be-all, end-all is the playoff. So I preface, yep, all that to say, you know, the previous 2 years, there was no Big Ten team that was in there.
Yep.
And a lot of people are wondering, okay, is it inevitable it goes to eight? From your position as somebody, mm-hmm, whose interest is the Big Ten, but now as you see it, where do you want this thing to go more than just where do you think it should go?
Yeah, I believe, you know, it's sort of an ironic place that we find ourselves because, you know, we went from zero to two, and that was good. That was fine. I mean, if we didn't make the two, it was okay. We went and played in the Rose Bowl, and, you know, somebody else played in the BCS, and BCS was, you know, kind of crazy. I mean, we created it, and then the same people who created it ripped it. So, you know, I really don't believe in creating something and ripping it. But that's what we did, along with the public. But we ourselves criticized it for 100 different reasons. So where we are today, you know, we've fashioned a compromise. The irony to me is we've doubled the excess, but more than doubled the angst over exclusion. And I think the way I understand it, the way I feel about it, is that there are more than two or three interests in college football. There's a Cinderella issue. There's a issue associated with conference champions. There's an issue associated with conference championship games that need to be kept healthy. But there are also issues on the other side about length of season and so on and so forth. And so I think that ultimately we're going to need to expand because I think of the as I identify the issues, I don't think we're coming as close to accommodating the interests as we were with two teams or with no teams. And I know nothing gets smaller. So I think probably given where we are, ultimately it should expand. The question is how does it expand in a way that accommodates the big interest in college football, which I think are the conferences, which I think is the notion of Cinderella, which also provides some access for teams that are capable of winning a national championship in a way that still maintains integrity and specialness of regular season and is not too invasive of the academic calendar or putting too much on any particular player, teams, and coaches. So it's not going to be easy because there's a series of complex contracts that are in place and because I don't think there is a consensus on this point. But the more interests that are unaccommodated, you know, it was the exclusion of Auburn that drove the SEC to move beyond the two. The SEC put together two, Roy and Gene were the leaders on that, Gene Corrigan, and we came in to help make it occur. And then there was a desire, I think it'd been, you know, maybe 98 to, you know, 2007, 8, 9. It was okay, but the public wanted more, and then the SEC wanted more, joined by the ACC, and eventually they got more. And now that we're here, I think ask the Pac-12, ask the Big 12, I think, yes, the Big Ten. I don't have the solution, but I do think that there's a problem that needs to be accommodated at some point, whether it's at the end of the agreement. I think it's more likely at the end than in the middle, but who knows? It depends on who's feeling excluded.
Well, when you guys decided on four, obviously at that time it was – I mean, one thing people I think forget is that the Big East, when you started those discussions, the Big East was still a AQ conference. So at that point, it would have been six competing for four. It ended up being five competing for four. So you knew there would be a tension there. Is the issue that you didn't anticipate, maybe people didn't anticipate how much it would be the same conferences over and over?
I think intellectually we knew somebody was going to be left out. But, you know, in the if you're an optimist, you think it's going to be somebody else left out. So, you know, I think you're exactly right. We knew that, you know, four slots couldn't take care of five conference champions. We knew that we had sort of instructed the committee on how to break ties. So I think two things. One is the reality of getting left out 1 year. But then the reality of getting left out 2 years, or in some cases, some conferences, 3 years, that has a direct effect on your ability to recruit, your ability to telecast events, and your branding. And so I think over time, there's a profound negative effect. And when you think about the group of five not having even close access, and then when you think about the conference schedules being so different, I think you look at it after 5 or 6 years and maybe have a more realistic view of what actually has occurred here. It's popular, more popular than it's ever been. You have to credit that. ESPN has done a great job in telecasting it. It has subordinated other bowls, but it also, I think, interestingly, has elevated those bowls. I think that the fact that the Rose Bowl could host an SC, Penn State series of champions who are excluded, pretty darn good game. And if I look at the ratings, I see the followership of that game being equal to other semifinal games. And so whether it's Ohio State being a champion twice and excluded, they ended up in the Rose Bowl and I think won a couple games. And so they are excited about that. I think Wisconsin is a very good football team, a top 10 football team, playing an Oregon team that's a pretty good team. So I think it's still great, but there's no doubt about it that the elevation of the semis and the champ game capture the imagination in a way. But there's also, to me, a place for the Rose Bowl, and we've got to figure it out, or not we, they have to figure it out. Over the longer term. And again, still, I think, while our fan base would all like to go to the semifinal game and we would like to go to the semifinal game, we also understand that in a lot of ways, this relationship still is as important as it was 30 years ago.
Jim, you mentioned about the scheduling and it's not uniform. I mean, you have certain conferences play 9 conference games and some play 8, and that certainly can prop up not just individual top 5 teams, but the teams that come up on their, you know, whether they matter in the top 25 as the committee ranks them. So getting to that, you have the Pac-12 has not had a team in the playoff now since Washington 4 years ago, and you can argue that, okay, the conference schedules are different. Also, the fact that there's not one probably doesn't help the recruiting branding of that conference. So is that more of a Larry Scott Pac-12 problem, or is that ultimately become a CFP problem as the relationship is if there's not some level of uniformity, if the access isn't quite the same?
Yeah, in the immediate sense, it's a Pac-12 problem. In a broader sense, it could happen to any of us because we go through cycles. You know, I remember the great Washington teams and the great SC teams, and that could easily flip and happen. I think it could. The teams and the conferences that are regularly involved now, they could go a couple years without being in. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Whether or not that will happen in any particular cycle, because I think certainly Alabama and Clemson have demonstrated a level of competency and competitiveness that they earned their way. But you see other things. I mean, to be honest with you, I never could understand how last year a two-loss Georgia team could be ahead of a one-loss Ohio State champion, given what we thought were the compromises. So there's, you know, if that happens and it flips, Larry's had to deal with it, Bob's had to deal with it, I've had to deal with it, but it could happen to anybody. It can. I mean, I think people are operating in total good faith, but I don't think that there's any necessarily consistency about what really matters. You know, does playing two FCS teams matter? Apparently it doesn't matter. If you play enough other good teams, does playing eight games versus nine matter? Does margin of victory? I mean, I know that margin of victory is not supposed to be incented, but I've seen three of our teams be, critiqued for losing a game by too many points. So I think there's a corollary to, you know, margin of victory, not incenting it, but also not incenting margin of losses. But all of these things are learned, committees change, and it could happen to anybody. And so I think we've got to figure out a way that, you know, teams that could win championships are in. I think there's a Cinderella aspect. I think there's a value proposition in terms of what it means for the regular season. And I think there's a student athlete and academic concern that has to be addressed. It's not going to be easy, but I think Larry's in a cycle that's been accentuated by the 14 playoff. And we knew it could happen, but after experiencing it for half a dozen years, it takes concrete form and it makes you start thinking about how you could improve it.
Over the years, you've said that one of the reasons – there were a lot of reasons why the BCS eventually transformed into the playoff, but one was there were a lot of pressures, external pressures, like there was an antitrust, you know, threat of an antitrust case from the government and things like that. And it feels to me like we're reaching that with NIL, where there are so many states now passing bills and Congress is involved. So, you know, that's obviously a big issue right now for college sports. I saw you quote, I mean, you've been quoted in several articles this week saying that it's not that you're opposed to it. It's just that you don't want it to reach a point where it impacts recruiting, where the recruiting process comes down to who can offer you the most, right? Opportunities to cash in on your likeness. In your mind, is that, first of all, is it inevitable that there is going to be some sort of change to the current policy? And if so, you know, in your mind, what would be the right model?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable that there'll be some change to modernization. You know, you can't see 20 state legislatures proposing or passing laws without understanding that we've done a pretty good job of uniting, you know, on social justice side as well as whatever you want to call it, I guess, you know, business entrepreneurial philosophy, you know, that somehow we're not doing it the right way. Having said that, I'm a believer that, you know, we're hemmed in a little bit here. We've got antitrust laws that apply to us that necessarily don't apply to professional sports. So, you know, we've got to get some certainty and we have to figure out what is okay. We have federal law related to Title IX. The professional sports don't have that. I think their ratio is like 97 to 3. So they don't have that consideration. I think it's the right thing to do, but it's also the legal thing to do. When we tried to limit coaches' salaries 15 years ago, I think we got hit with a $55 million settlement. So we're in a unique situation. We're obviously going to need a national solution, not a state by state solution. The NCAA is hamstrung because they don't have certain guidelines. Anything they do will end up probably in federal court as a defendant and antitrust. So this is the proposition I think we need. You know, we need some guidance in a couple of critical areas. needs to be done nationally. It needs to respect the difference, because I believe there's a difference between college sports that serve hundreds of universities and hundreds of thousands of students. And I believe there's broad public support for that. I mean, Arne Duncan has been, I think, an honest critic, but he'd also tell you that other than college sports, only probably the U.S. military provides more leadership, more opportunities than college sports. So I think there's public support for it, but not in all cases. I think people see it as out of balance, out of whack. And so if it could be a national solution, if we could get some guidance on Title IX and what's permissible under antitrust laws, if they think we're spending too much money in certain areas, how do we slow that down? How do we make sure that there are resources? But we're not the Olympics, and even in the Olympic environment, you know, what I would call, you know, Olympic licensing opportunities stop short of competing with the rings. So they're limited. We have a system that requires, you know, recruitment because students have choice. They're not allocated by draft. They're not told where to go. They choose where to go. And they're going to need, we need a method. It's an imperfect bite. I mean, I wish it was a stronger enforcement department, but it is the enforcement department that we have, not the one that we would, that I would necessarily want. So we're going to have a system that accommodates the fact that recruitment matters and the level playing field matters to some extent. We have to do it in a way that protects, I think, opportunities for women. I mean, it wasn't great for 100 years that women didn't have opportunities to participate and play, but society evolved. It wasn't right that African Americans were excluded from many colleges and universities for racial reasons. We made progress there. We have a circumstance now where, you know, a lot of people feel like it's not fair enough for the student, even though there's a broader franchise there. So there's some good things that deserve to be retained. We need some guidance. It needs to be national. And I'm adamant about this. I don't think we can have employees playing sports in college. I think they have to be students. We need clarification on that. And if we have employees rather than students, I mean, I think it falls its own weight. Maybe, you know, some people decide not to do it. I don't know. But I think there's things that we can do to modernize. I think it's a complicated environment. And I think we're in the right place in having conversations with the federal government about what these guidelines ought to be.
Jim, let me ask you, a few years ago, you expanded the conference, bringing in Rutgers, mm-hmm. bringing in Maryland. I'm sure you didn't realize that at the time, Rutgers football was going to completely fall off the map. I mean, when Greg Schiano was there, he had it rolling. And then the first year that I guess Rutgers was in there, Kyle Flood had an 8-win season. But after that, it's really fallen apart. For a lot of people who are skeptical looking at Rutgers and saying they seem to be an odd fit, is it as simple as saying if Greg Schiano can fix Rutgers football, this becomes a really savvy business move to have Rutgers as a part of it? I'm sure there's more to it, but is that what it would take, or what do you think it would take for people to go, yeah, oh, now I see why this makes so much sense?
You know, I don't know. You know, it depends on what your worldview is in evaluating expansion. You know, for some people, it's the record of the football and the basketball team. I get that. I mean, those are the two high-profile sports that we have. And Rutgers has an interesting legacy. They weren't even a public institution until 1958. You know, they were sort of in the same grouping as William and Mary and Harvard and Yale. They were, you know, King's Royal Colleges. So I think they have a totally different history, but at the same time, they're an elite, world-class research institution located in a contiguous state. And when I look at the ad of Maryland, Rutgers, in Penn State, I do not, while I'm totally aware of the fact that they have fallen on hard times in football, I have a belief that based on the richness of the students who play sports in that area, based on the revenues that they'll receive from us, based on the fact that they will find a coach to lead them. That, and having been put in probably the toughest division in the expanded conference, I think that they will be, but I can't tell you that's going to happen in a 2 to 3 year period. And I don't think that's the best way to judge whether or not it was the right move. Because to me, the best rationale for doing what we did is the whole structure of college organization changed. And we helped change it. It wasn't part of the strategic plan, but the Big Ten was at 10 for a long time. And that was considered to be a large conference. And we went to 11. It wasn't with the plan to go to 14. It was the plan to go to 11. And, whether or not that precipitated it, but the ACC went from the Middle Atlantic Conference to one into Florida and into Georgia and into South Carolina and eventually into Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania. So they went from a conference probably of, 40 or 50 million Americans to 100 million. The Pac-12, Arizona State, then Utah, Colorado, but they looked at Texas, and they couldn't get it done, but they looked at it. The SEC, moves to South Carolina, they moved to Arkansas, they moved to Missouri, they moved to Texas. So they have 100 million people in their footprint. So what once was an advantage for us in the recruitment of students and student athletes all of a sudden became, reduced. And so I think our need to get a little bit larger, to be a little more effective in recruitment. I don't care if you're recruiting federal research dollars, normal students, or students who play sports. We needed to be in that range of 100 million Americans, and we are. And it's with schools that are similar to us in terms of research. And the football and basketball on it is important. But it's not how I judge why we did what we did. And I think based on the richness of the talent in that area, all kinds of talent, I think it'll stand the test of time. But it's a long explanation to say, hey, they haven't won a football game in the conference for 2 years, and therefore it was bad expansion. I don't believe it was bad expansion at all.
My last topic that I wanted to ask you about is kind of the larger structure of college sports and where you see that heading. I think about 5 years ago, there was a pretty significant change in that the NCAA membership acknowledged that the five most resourced conferences are operating a little bit differently than everybody else, and you have that autonomy structure. And that allows you guys to vote on certain things, but there's a lot of limitations on it. As you look 10, 15 years down the road, we assume that TV deals will continue to get bigger and bigger. And then, of course, there's this NIL.
Don't always assume that. I don't think that's the right assumption. And I say that with the full awareness that they have had that over the last 25 years. But when they broke the monopoly of NCAA football in 85, the numbers actually went down. And they really didn't establish the same nominal value till about 1992. And it's true that since then, there's been gradual increases and then substantial increases as, people started networks and built out and college football became more popular. But I don't think there's anything, maybe with the exception of the NFL, that goes up, up, and up. So while you may be right, it may slow down a bit. I'm not predicting it'll slow down, but I'm not also counting on the kinds of growth over the next 25 years that we had over the last 25 years. But your point is the right one. We got autonomy. In my view, after we get a resolution in Congress, I hope we're able to stay in a big tent. I hope the basketball tournament stays as it is. I hope that other conferences have access through automatic bids of various kinds. But I do think that there probably will be a need for probably more autonomy. But I don't think it needs to be a separate organization. I think a lot of this stuff can work, but I don't think there's any doubt that once we get the rules of the game more clearly understood, there's still going to be need for legislation and building out a system that works. And that probably implies for me If I were to project out 5 or 7 years, there'll be additional discussion about autonomy, but not necessarily breaking away.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we don't know. It's hard to say what will happen with the NIL piece, but, you know, does it become harder for that? Does that become another tension on the Big Ten philosophy where can Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, et cetera, continue to coexist with schools that, you know, are fortunate to be making a couple $100,000 a year in TV revenue?
You know, I think that's it's a great point. I think certain sports, you know, and how you sponsor sports, it really has separated and has been separated for decades and decades. I think for the most part, on academic standards, once we find out whether it's okay to regulate the number of coaches, you know, or any other recruiting rule, to be on the same field competitively does not necessarily imply that we have to have 330 schools vote on every issue. It doesn't follow that you can't have a big tent competitively, but a smaller tent with regard to the rules and regulations that govern the competition. We do it in a couple of areas now. I think we could probably do it in more areas. It may well be that enforcement works one way, you know, in the Ivy League, but maybe we need a different kind of enforcement. Maybe it's more invasive. I don't know. Maybe we need to have stronger regulations in and around playing and practice, how much time can be spent, than perhaps the Ivy League needs, because maybe we push the envelope in that area. But whatever it is, I can conceive of an event that allows everybody to play, but also a governance system that empowers schools with particular challenges to be able to legislate and work those out without schools with far fewer resources dictating what the outcome might be.
All right, Jim, we appreciate your time to joining us on the Audible today. It's really been great to get your perspective on such a such an interesting time in college football and college athletics in general. And thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and appreciate what you guys have done. Been watching your careers for a long time, and appreciate the way that we've been treated. You don't always like what everybody says all the time, but you always appreciate the role that you know, the media plays. And talk about change. I don't know that any the guys inside the media have had to change more than people on the outside. So, you know, I appreciate and wish you guys the best, and thanks for the opportunity.
You didn't have to do podcasts in 1989.
I'm not sure that I'm really up to date on the podcast world anyway, but I may be doing one. Who knows? You know, I have friends that said, "Oh, you can do a podcast." I said, "Well, I'm gonna have to make sure that I fully understand what that entails."
But, once you do,
I
you'll
appreciate
get
it. Yeah, and I appreciate you guys, and have a great holiday season. And maybe we'll see you in Phoenix or in Pasadena.
All right, thank you so much, Jim.
Sounds good, Jim. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
All right, Bruce. Well, that was a great interview. And now we wish everybody happy holidays this week and safe travels to you as you head out to Atlanta for your game. And I will go to Phoenix for mine, and I'll touch base later in the week. If you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating if you could, too. It helps us get the word out. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, what are you waiting for? You can get 40% off an annual subscription by using this link, theathletic.com/theaudible. That's 40% off your subscription to The Athletic. We'll talk about it for years.